So now I'd like to introduce you to our speaker, Dr. Chris Forbes, who lectures in ancient history at Macquarie University, and ask him a few questions. So how long have you been at Macquarie?
I'm sorry to say that the answer is most of my life. as in undergraduate, postgraduate, spent a little bit of time visiting Cambridge, a little bit of time visiting Fuller Seminary in Pasadena,
yeah.
But most of the rest has been at Macquarie.
Yeah.
So, oh, and occasional visits to UTS, of course.
That's good. So is it true that you originally planned to study law?
Absolutely. I had been in school debating and I thought, barrister. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
But when I went to Macquarie, you didn't do law until second year.
Yeah.
And I never got there.
Yeah. So what changed your mind?
Well, what essentially changed my mind is the professor of ancient history, because within about 4 weeks of his lectures, I'd been completely hypnotised. And I've told him it's his fault. I've explained this to him, and he is unrepentant.
Yeah. So was it true what Henry Ford said, that history was bunk?
Henry Ford, the inventor of automation and factory line processing, who invented the Ford motor car, is on record as saying that history is bunk. And I have to say that I am so much a historian that my first question is, yes, but in what context did he say that? And, you know, I've seriously been completely unable to find out. I don't know any way of knowing why the subject of history even came up. But I think Henry must be wrong, or at least I think almost everyone thinks Henry is wrong, because your own personal history actually really matters to you. Think of how people who've been adopted really care about finding out who their birth parents are. Think about the fact that all of us have a national and cultural history that we actually care about, and if it turns out parts of it are wrong, it matters. Some of the history we've been taught may be bunk, but if it is, I think most of us want to know.
Thank you for that. So now I'll just invite Becky to come up and give us the Bible reading before Chris comes and gives us the talk.
So I'm a fifth-year student studying software engineering in BCII, although maybe by the end of the day I'll have swapped to history.
Warning.
I'm just going to read a few verses from the book of 1 Corinthians. Now, brothers and sisters, I want to remind you of the gospel I preached to you, which you received and on which you have taken your stand. By this gospel you are saved if you hold firmly to the word I preached to you. Otherwise, you've believed in vain. For what I received, I passed on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day and according to the scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas and then to the 12. After that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, he appeared to me also, as to one abnormally born.
Now I'll hand back over to Chris. Please be listening carefully, because you'll have the opportunity at the end to ask Chris any questions you might think of during the talk.
Thank you. Having been briefly introduced, I won't give any more introduction except to say that I have 5 basic points that I want to make. And some of them are, or at least ought to be, historically uncontroversial, regardless of your Christian or other point of view. Others are not uncontroversial, and I'll tell you which ones are which as we go through. I won't be able to deal with all the details of some of the claims I'm going to be making in the time that I have here with you, but I will be perfectly happy to take up details with you either in the question and answer time that follows, or else for about half an hour after the session if you're able to stay. And if you particularly want to ask me questions, you can always contact me by email as well. I should warn you, if warn is quite the right word, that personally I'm a committed Christian, but professionally I am also a committed ancient historian. I teach subjects both to do with the rise of early Christianity and Greco-Roman mainstream ancient history, and it is my aim to use the same historical methods and the same kinds of evidence and arguments in both cases, both when dealing with the Bible and in dealing with the wider world of the first century and on either side of it in the Mediterranean. And it's my aim today to only use arguments based on historical evidence which could be accepted by people regardless of their personal religious convictions or complete lack of them. I'm a bit uncomfortable with some of the arguments that he used to prove the resurrection of Jesus. I think they're much better at proving it to somebody who already believes it than to somebody who doesn't. But it's my intention, as I said, to only use arguments which are as valid for someone who is not a Christian as for someone who is. So, now that's interesting. My first point has come up as my second point. There's a previous point there that hasn't come through, and I don't know why. Clearly, it's a Macintosh problem. Oh, don't worry, I'm multi-denominational. I'm reading my notes from an iPad and I've got an Android phone, despite being an Anglican. The first point I'm going to be making is the claim, and it should be an uncontroversial historical claim, that the earliest clear evidence we have for the details of the belief in the resurrection comes from the passage you heard read to you just a couple of minutes ago, 1 Corinthians 15, particularly verses 3 to 7, written around about 55 AD. The important claim I'm going to be making is that this evidence is the earliest because it goes back to before 40 AD, and that is less than 10 years after the death of Jesus. Jesus died in either 30 or 33 AD in mid-April. Historians aren't sure whether it was 30 or 33. If people are particularly interested in knowing the reasons why, they're sure it's one of the two, but not sure which one. I can explain that as an answer to a question later. But the point is, I'm going to be claiming that the earliest evidence we have in 1 Corinthians goes back to before 40 AD, less than 10 years after the events. Now, it's understandable that when we talk about the resurrection of Jesus, people think first of all of the Gospels. But they're not the earliest Christian documents. The earliest known Christian documents are the letters of St. Paul, written between about 48 AD at the earliest, plus or minus a year or so, we don't know with absolute precision, down to the late 50s or early 60s AD, and the resurrection of Jesus is taken for granted as a fact in those letters. But the most detailed discussion, and the only one which provides us with historically useful evidence of how early Christians argued for the belief in the resurrection, is 1 Corinthians 15, and the longer discussion that follows from the short passage you have read. Now, I'm going to be claiming that that's the earliest evidence and then talking about the nature of the claim that St. Paul is specifically making. And I'm going to be asking these five basic questions. Ah, now it's coming back in order. Good. What is the earliest evidence for this belief? Answer, the passage in 1 Corinthians. What exactly was St. Paul claiming in 1 Corinthians? How reliably has the evidence for this belief been reported? And now I'm talking not about 1 Corinthians, but about the Gospels. Where might such a belief have originated? The idea that somebody could have risen from the dead, where would such an idea have come from in the first century world? And the fifth question, how did the early Christians argue for this belief? Those are the five questions that I'll be dealing with, one by one, and we'll come back to each of them in summary. The earliest evidence for this belief is 1 Corinthians 15, written somewhere between 53 and 55 AD. Now let's just whip through these headings and look at the passage itself carefully. Here it is. 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3 to 8. I handed on to you, says Paul, introducing his material, as of the first importance, what I in turn had received. Question number one. When did Paul hand this message on to the Corinthians? Now, for reasons that I'm perfectly willing to go into in answer to a question later, if you want to follow up the details, historians are totally confident that St. Paul's visit to Corinth, mentioned in Acts chapter 18, can be dated to the year 51 AD, plus or minus about 6 months. That's when Paul first preached in Corinth to the Corinthians and handed on to them what he himself had received, which he then goes on to say in his quotation. But the question is, when had he received it? Because he received it before he handed it on to the Corinthians. That, I take it, is obvious. You've got to have something before you can pass it on. And Paul himself tells us in his letter to the Galatians, 1:18, about the chronology of his visits to Jerusalem. And he tells us, then after 3 years, after he'd been in Damascus and gone into Arabia for an uncertain period, he did go up to Jerusalem to visit Cephas. Cephas, by the way, is simply the Aramaic word for Peter. It's simply the translation of Peter's name from Aramaic, and Petros is the Greek form. I did go up to Jerusalem to visit Cephas and stayed with him for 15 days. Slightly over a fortnight. And the chronology of Paul's career tells us with some degree of certainty that this visit must have happened before 40 AD. Now, as I said, that information can be argued by historians regardless of their Christian point of view. There is very little doubt, very little reasonable doubt, that the list of those who saw Jesus after his resurrection originates in Jerusalem before 40 AD, that is to say, within 10 years or less of the actual events. This is historically very early evidence indeed. Not only that, but we need to look, question two, at what precisely these passages are claiming about the nature of the resurrection. Sorry, I'll just coordinate with my notes here. I think it's very clear from what Paul says that he believes that the resurrection of Jesus was physical, that it was a physical resurrection. This is often doubted, and it's pointed out perfectly correctly that Paul never mentions the empty tomb of Jesus, which is mentioned in the Gospels. Though he does mention the fact that Jesus was buried in a tomb, he doesn't mention that the tomb was found empty. And the deduction is made by some sceptical scholars that Paul may believe in what we might call some sort of a spiritual resurrection that doesn't need an empty tomb. That Jesus' body, of course, remained in the tomb and, predictably with bodies, rotted. But that Jesus, in some sense, his spirit was transported into the heavens and he was vindicated by God. The claim is that the earliest Christian idea of resurrection, in Paul's letters, might not be a physical resurrection. That idea might only have developed later and become part of Christianity by the time the Gospels were written. But I think this is most unlikely, partly in principle and partly because of what Paul actually says. The reason it's unlikely in principle is that Paul is Jewish, he is a Pharisaic sort of Jew, and Jews who, like the Pharisees, believed in life after death, because not all Jews did, firmly believed that life after death would come in the form of a physical resurrection. The evidence of various Jewish sources, including the Jewish historian Josephus, not a Christian at all, is very clear on this point. If Paul is going to believe in a life after death, it is likely in principle that he will believe in a physical resurrection, not something more ethereal, something more quote-unquote spiritual. But it's more than that, because if you have a look at the passage in 1 Corinthians 15 that follows the passage we've read, the passage about the nature of resurrection, where Paul argues about what resurrection is like with the Corinthians, have a look at the language he uses. Someone will ask, how are the dead raised? With what kind of body do they come? Fool, what you sow does not come to life unless it dies. And as for what you sow, you do not sow the body that is to be, but a bare seed, perhaps of wheat or some other grain, but God gives it a body. Do you notice the whole discussion is about bodies? The whole discussion he's having with the Corinthians is about, if there is life after death, what kind of body will it have, taking for granted that it will have a body? The metaphors he uses make that clear. He goes on, not all flesh is alike. There is one flesh for human beings, another for animals, another for birds, another for fish. There are both heavenly bodies and earthly bodies. And then he goes on. But his whole discussion is about bodies. He takes that absolutely for granted. What puzzles people is that he says that Christ was raised and Christians will be raised as a spiritual body. And most of us, in the aftermath of René Descartes' idea of the difference between the physical and the spiritual, think that spiritual means immaterial, not as real as physical. Physical means real, and spiritual means ethereal and not as real. That is precisely not what Paul means. Have a look at the way he talks about what will happen at the resurrection. This perishable body must put on imperishability. Not this perishable body must be stripped off to leave an imperishable spirit. No, the perishable body remains and must put on imperishability. This mortal body must put on immortality. When this perishable body puts on imperishability and this mortal body puts on immortality, then the saying that is written will be fulfilled: death has been swallowed up in victory. You see, what Paul is saying is the process of becoming an immortal being is not a process of having physicality removed from you. It's a process of having immortality added to physicality. Physicality being transformed not into something that is less than physical, but into something that is more than physical. Physical and more. Physical and empowered by the Spirit of God is what makes a spiritual body. And Paul believes that both Christ and the future resurrected Christians will have spiritual bodies which are transformed physical bodies that are more than merely spiritual. So the evidence is quite clear that the earliest understanding of resurrection that we have anywhere in the New Testament is about a physical resurrection, and you cannot sensibly argue that it starts off not being physical and then ends up being mythologized into a physical resurrection by the time you get to the Gospels. Paul, Mark, the earliest of the Gospel writers, and John, probably the latest of the Gospel writers, are in agreement that the resurrection of Jesus was a physical thing. Now that's questions one and two. What is the earliest evidence, and what is the nature of the claim that the evidence is making? My next major claim, and hopefully we get back to, the mainstream of the argument, is how reliably has the evidence in the Gospels for the resurrection of Jesus been passed on in the 30 to 60 years or so between the death of Jesus and when the Gospels came to be written? Dating the composition of the Gospels is not an exact science, but the great majority of scholars who work in the field would agree that Mark was probably the first Gospel to be written, that it was written either slightly before or slightly after 70 AD, and if people would like to, this is another thing we can talk about the detailed reasons for afterwards. The great majority of scholars would also agree that Matthew and Luke were written sometime later, but probably partly dependent on Mark. Matthew and Luke have fairly clearly read Mark and use great chunks of Mark, virtually word perfect. We can't really know which of Matthew and Luke wrote first, but it's very likely that they wrote independently in the 70s up to the mid-80s AD, And again, if people would like to talk about the reasons that we think this, we can go into that later on. Finally, it's normally argued that John's Gospel was written last, perhaps somewhere in the 90s AD, and it's controversial among historians whether John was aware of the other three or not. But whether he was aware of them or not, it's clear he has other sources of information as well. That's the background. But now we have to look at the way the gospel writings pass on the story about Jesus' resurrection and ask, in principle, can we tell how careful they've been with the details they report? And I want to suggest that the gospel accounts, though they vary, show remarkably little elaboration in their reporting of the events of what we call the first Easter. In my view, they resemble much more honest, though sometimes confused, reporting of remarkable events, rather than looking like theological embroidery. They do not look to me, as a historian, as if they are simply Christians sermonizing on the idea of resurrection. Why not? In the first instance, because they don't fit together neatly. It is actually not easy to put together a detailed account of the events of Jesus' resurrection, of who saw what and in what order. It is clear from this that the Gospels we're dealing with are at least partly independent lines of testimony. They have not been neatly jigsawed together to make a polished narrative. If they did fit together neatly and perfectly, a historian in me would be very suspicious indeed that this was some kind of a put-up job. But the fact that the Gospels are at least partly independent of each other looks to me like a good sign. Though it's not easy, it is nonetheless possible to put together, from the Gospels that we have, a reasonably coherent story of who saw what and approximately when they saw it. And the third thing that fundamentally impresses me about the way the Gospels pass on this material is going to deeply annoy at least half of you, the female half of you. Because the fact that the Gospels choose as their primary witness to the resurrection of Jesus, Mary Magdalene, seems to me to be a quite remarkable thing. In both ancient Jewish and ancient Greco-Roman courts of law, women's testimony did not count for nearly as much as men's testimony because, to put it simply, women were not considered equally rational. I told you it'd annoy you. But it is nonetheless true that in that world, the testimony of a woman simply did not count at the same level as the testimony of a man, and yet the Gospels report that Mary Magdalene was the first eyewitness. Now, we know what Greco-Roman authors thought about this. In the 3rd century AD, Celsus, a pagan critic of Christianity, absolutely ridicules the early Christians for believing on the resurrection on the basis of the evidence of a hysterical woman. Ridiculous and typical is Celsus's point of view. The fact that the Gospels, despite knowing full well that this point will not go in their favour, report that Mary was the first witness seems to me to suggest strongly that she actually was. And they were stuck with it. And they do not cover up what is a point that must weaken their propaganda. Not only this, but in the Gospels there is very little reporting of things that nobody could have seen or known. What we get in the Gospels is reports of what particular people, usually particular named people, saw and reported on. We don't get stories of what happened in the voice of the narrator with no one there to let us know how they found out. We get reports going back to usually named eyewitnesses. But there are two other really important points that I want to make, and that is the lack of theological elaboration in the gospel accounts of the resurrection. We know quite a bit historically about what early Christians thought the, quote, special effects would be when the resurrection of everybody came. They knew what a resurrection ought to look like. They talk about it in the context of their discussions of the final resurrection at the end of the world. According to 1 Thessalonians 4:16, it will come with the call of the archangel. In Matthew 24:41 and in 1 Thessalonians 4:6 and in 1 Corinthians 15:52, we get the language of the last trumpet. That will come at the time of the resurrection. There's the idea that there will be the first fruits of all mankind present at the resurrection. And possibly an exposition of Daniel chapter 12, which says, and I quote, "Many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the sky, and those who lead many to righteousness will shine like the stars forever and ever." Trumpets, starlight, glory, all of these are the kind of special effects that you'd have to build into a movie to describe the resurrection as the early Christians understood it. But note, none of these things, no angels blowing trumpets, no shining like stars, feature at all in the gospel accounts of Jesus' resurrection. Despite the fact that the early Christians believed that that's what a resurrection looked like, they do not report these things as features of Jesus' resurrection. In other words, they do not read back their own preferred theological language and impose it on the reports. Now, the most striking example of this is the fact that the early Christians loved and passed on to us a regular phrase which anyone who's a regular churchgoer can recite. On the third day, he rose again in accordance with the scriptures. Now, you know where it comes from. It's Paul's phrase from 1 Corinthians 15:4. It's also, of course, in the great creeds, which are recited in virtually all churches. It's possibly related to the promise that God would appear at Mount Sinai on the third day after the Israelites arrived there. It's also a theme taken up in the prophet Hosea chapter 6, verse 2, who says of the great day of resurrection, "After 2 days, God will revive us. On the third day, he will raise us up so that we might live before him." In other words, this "on the third day" language is there in the Bible for early Christians to get the hang of and to use as a natural proof text for the resurrection. It's probably also part of early Christian theology, tied to the view that Jesus' death at the time of Passover was like a Passover sacrifice, because on the third day after Passover, the first fruits, the first sheaf of the grain harvest, was consecrated in the temple, and Jesus' resurrection was understood as the first fruits of the dead. In other words, theologically, the early Christians are going to be thinking on the third day thoughts quite a lot, for quite a lot of scriptural reasons. And in some passages, they do. In Mark's gospel, where Jesus predicts his resurrection, we are told that it will come after 3 days. But in the parallels in Matthew and Luke, they change that to on the third day to make it sound more like the language they're used to. They like the phrase on the third day. But despite all of this background, the phrase on the third day is not used in the gospel resurrection narratives, despite the fact that Matthew and Luke record that Jesus predicted that's when he'd rise. When they report the resurrection, check this for yourself to make sure I'm not just making it up. All the gospels say the resurrection of Jesus happened on the day after the Sabbath. That's all. Despite the fact that their heads are full of third day language, they don't read that theological language back into the reports. They simply say, which day was it? It was the day after the Sabbath. In other words, how reliably has the evidence for this belief been reported? I think what's remarkable is how little the early Christians have embroidered the accounts with theological language. What they have basically done is report what they think happened. without the special effects, without the extra theological language. There are gaps in the story that aren't easy to explain. There's not much theological hindsight. Images of resurrection from other parts of the Bible are not used, and particularly the on the third day language isn't used in the description of Jesus' resurrection. The reports lack the precision we'd expect if it was a put-up job. It looks like reasonably reliable reporting. The earliest witness? Mary Magdalene. Now, there are two more points that we need to make. And the first of these is more controversial than most of the others I've been making, which are probably historically largely uncontroversial. Question four, where might the idea of a resurrection of the dead have come from in the ancient world? Now, notice please, I am not asking where might the idea that Jesus rose from the dead have come from. That's not my question. My question is bigger. My question is, where might the idea that anybody might rise from the dead have come from in that world? Because basically, scholars have put forward two solutions to this question. One suggests that it developed in the Greco-Roman world, which, they say, had beliefs in lots of dying and rising gods, and Jesus is just another one of those. Now, the problem with this claim, which was originally made, well over a century and a half ago and became very popular in the early 20th century, is that it's badly out of date. Scholars nowadays are not persuaded that there were actually very many dying and rising gods in the ancient world at all. It's still quite a popular claim in pop literature, but that's because the people who write the pop literature aren't reading what the real historians are saying. Serious point. There aren't nearly as many dying and rising gods as scholars used to think. Simply the most common title for the gods among most Greek writers is the immortal gods. Gods don't die, that's the point. Humans are mortal, we die, gods don't. Dying and rising gods are rare. The one best example of a dying and rising god is the Egyptian god Osiris, who is believed to die every autumn as the winter comes and the green growth dies down, and to be reborn and to rise from the dead every spring as the new growth comes. But there are two really important things you need to notice about this belief in the dying and rising god. Number one, Osiris dies and rises to become king of the underworld, and he stays there. He never comes back to earth. He never comes back to rule over the world. He becomes king of the underworld and stays put in the world of the dead. Not quite what the early Christians were claiming about Jesus. But more importantly, if you were to ask a Greco-Roman believer in Osiris, and there were many of them, what year it was that Osiris rose from the dead, they would look at you as if you were weird. Why? It's a little bit like asking a modern Australian Aboriginal what year it was that the rainbow serpent carved out the banks of the Todd River. It's a silly question. That was in the Dreamtime. The Dreamtime doesn't have dates. The Dreamtime doesn't have a chronology. And in the same way, Greco-Roman people believed fundamentally that Osiris died and rose, mythologically speaking, every winter, rose every spring. And by contrast with that, the early Christians were claiming that Jesus died and rose again under Pontius Pilate at a time and a place in human history. They were claiming an actual event, not a mythological metaphor. I think, therefore, the idea cannot come from the Greco-Roman idea of dying and rising gods. Can it come from the Jewish idea that at one stage at the end of the world there will be the great resurrection of the dead? Yes and no. Why? Because what the early Christians are claiming is that Jesus has not got to wait for the end of the world to rise from the dead. He rises from the dead in the 30s or 33 AD under Pontius Pilate in Judea. And you see how paradoxical it is for the early Christians to make this claim. What they're claiming is that the resurrection of the dead has begun. The end of the world has come a little bit. Jesus has risen from the dead in the middle of history. And that is an extraordinary thing to claim and very hard to explain in Greco-Roman or Jewish terms. Final point, and I'm aware that we're running close to the wire here in terms of time. So, not the Greek world, not dying and rising gods. The contrast between myth and history. Didn't deal with that one, we can come back to that. The Jewish world, the fact that the early Christian claim that Jesus had risen from the dead appears to be a striking paradox. How did the early Christians argue for this belief is my fifth and final question. The reason I ask this is that the early Christians could easily have chosen to present the belief in the resurrection consciously in mythological terms. They could have said, this is our myth. This is the story we tell about life and death. That would have been perfectly acceptable in their culture. They could have argued that resurrection was their central metaphor. People would have understood that. But instead, they resolutely argued that their belief was based on relatively recent events, which they clearly believed to be historical events. In very brief, what I am claiming is the historical evidence for the resurrection is earlier than most people realise, before 40 AD, within less than 10 years. Second, more consistent than most people realise. It does not develop from a kind of ethereal resurrection to something more physical over time. It is believed to be physical from the very beginning. Third, it is less embellished with theological developments than most people realise. The early Christians don't seem to have modified it to fit their developing theology. It is harder to explain in its cultural context than most people realise, and overall, it is simply more historically persuasive than most of the theories put forward to explain it. To put it very simply, why should you believe in a resurrection from the dead? Because it's a wonderful metaphor for the resilience of life? Because it talks about the turning of the seasons? Doesn't really work in the southern hemisphere, of course, but works really well in the northern hemisphere. Every spring you have Easter. Could you claim it as a kind of mystical understanding of the nature of life? All of those would be possible. But what Paul says is, why should you Corinthians believe that Jesus rose from the dead? Answer, because I have more than 500 eyewitnesses, most of whom are still alive. Talk to them. That is a remarkable claim. More than 500 eyewitnesses, most of whom are still alive, making the factual claim that the resurrection of Jesus was a real, physical, historical event. It seems to me that this might well be a sign of something fairly important. Time for questions. Do you want to moderate the questions or will I do that? Okay. Anybody? Yes. 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 The answer is that we know that Jesus' death was locked into the chronology of Passover. Now, Jewish Passover works on a lunar calendar, which can be astronomically back calculated, and Jesus has to be executed on a Friday, which is the day before Passover. Now, Passover moves around the days of the week. So, astronomically, it's possible to back calculate which Passovers in roughly the time span from, say, 20 to 40 AD have Passover coming the day after a Friday, and those are the only two it can be. So it's partly historical evidence and partly astronomical evidence that lead us to the death of Jesus being in either 30 or 33 and not any of the other dates. Anybody else?
Yeah,
Yes.
Jesus, that is recalled in the history of Roman or not? And the empty tomb, is it recorded or not recorded?
The answer is Jesus' death is mentioned by a number of non-Christian Greco-Roman historians. They also mention that even long after his death, he still has followers. In the first century, none of them mentioned the idea of the empty tomb, but they clearly know that Christians believe Jesus rose from the dead. But no, the non-Christian sources do not mention the empty tomb. Yes?
Do those sources, the non-Christian ones, mention all these eyewitnesses, that Paul does?
No, I don't think so. There is some mention of later members of Jesus' family still being leaders of the movement in Judea, but that's in the mid-2nd century AD. As far as I'm aware, it's only Paul, with his evidence going back to the 40s, who has the list of details, aside from what you find in the Gospels.
Yep.
Yes. Good question. I don't think anyone knows. Luke's Gospel also has a genealogy, though not at the very beginning, but it works in the opposite direction, which makes it hard to cross-compare them. But it may be that some Jewish people kept records of their ancestry to make it clear that they knew which tribes they belonged to. But to put it very simply, I don't think we know how Matthew and Luke got the information they have. For the resurrection accounts, I think they give us far more clues, but not for the birth narratives and the genealogies. Anybody else? Yes?
Is there any significance on the folded napkin in the tomb when Jesus resurrected?
Now, I think that's only mentioned in John's Gospel. Is that right?
Sure.
I think so. When Peter and John run to the tomb, and one of them goes in and the other one doesn't, but only looks in, they see the grave clothes lying still folded up and to one side. And I think the most general interpretation of that is nobody has unwrapped Jesus and taken his body away, because if they did, the wrappings would be everywhere, whereas they were just neatly folded where they had been. Somebody has left them behind. And the general theory seems to be with the napkin that folded his head simply lying separate because it fell off when he was no longer in it. I think that's the general understanding of what John means. Probably last chance for one question now. Yes?
There's lots of talk about the Shroud of Turin. What do you make of that? What are the claims?
For those who don't know, the Shroud of Turin is a fascinating piece of ancient fabric, which, when examined photographically, seems to have on it the image of a man who has been crucified. It is probably, of all the claimed relics of the lifetime of Jesus, the one that was most likely to have had a chance to be genuine, because there are any number of relics which have absolutely zero chance of being genuine. Sorry, I'm a bit of a skeptic on this material, but that's what being a historian does to you. The Shroud of Turin in the 70s probably had the strongest claim for being genuinely ancient. And if it was genuinely ancient, the figure on it looked like the figure of a man who'd been crucified. What do we make of this? How did the figure get there? Don't know, looks pretty weird to me. But carbon dating of the Shroud of Turin was eventually permitted, and the carbon dating by three independent laboratories agreed that though it was very old, it was not 1st century AD. It probably came, if I remember correctly, from about 1100 AD. So the odds are that the Shroud of Turin is a fascinating weirdness, but not a genuine relic of Jesus. There are still, of course, people who simply dismiss the carbon dating and still want to believe in it. I have problems with that. Sorry, do we have time for one more? Yes, last one.
Are there secular sources of the reactions of the wider world against this claim? How they react to the claim of resurrection?
There are Greco-Roman writers who comment on this. in the early to mid second century and later. None that I know of from the first century. One who comments on Jesus' death in the first century, but not on the resurrection. The ones who comment on the resurrection basically say, silly idea. And the reason is simple. For most Greco-Roman people, resurrection would not be a physical thing. Life after death was a transformed spiritual thing, not a physical thing. So the idea that Christians believed in a physical resurrection just seemed to them to be a bizarre concept. Jews didn't think it was a bizarre concept, but many Greco-Roman intellectuals did.